Dr. Shatterimus. Rather than continue on the seven-step plan for ridding the world of Islamic terrorism, I'm going to postpone that to the first hour tomorrow. And what I'd like to do now is continue to present the argument against Paul. And to do that, we're going to go to the very first statement that he wrote and the very first letter that he wrote, which was to the Galatians. Christian New Testament is a hodgepodge. It throws these letters together, not in chronological order, which, the fact is it's not scripture. The fact is it's not divinely inspired, so, I don't much care. But if you're a Christian, you ought to have wanted to have these things established in chronological order, because context is just so essential for understanding. And to do that, you with Paul's letters, in fact, Paul wrote his letter to the Galatians perhaps earlier than we have copies of Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John, and therefore Acts as well. There is the possibility that Matanyah, the disciple, may have written his Hebrew version of his account of what Yosha said and did, in Hebrew at least, within a few years of Yosha's fulfillment in 33 CE of Pesach, Matzah, Bekodim, and Shavua. But it was not translated into Greek and widely distributed until probably after 50 CE, which is when this letter to the Galatians was scribed by Paul. Yohanan, we don't have a date on his writing of his eyewitness account, but I would assume that it was probably also right around this time. We don't know if his original account was written in Hebrew and Greek. He would have been fluent in Hebrew. He probably would not have understood Aramaic, and there is that he would have had to have taught himself Greek over time. So it's highly likely he would have written in Hebrew as well, but we just don't have a copy of this in Hebrew, of what he wrote in Hebrew. The reason, by the way, we don't have copies, and we know they existed, is because the rabbis in Jerusalem throughout Yehuda were extraordinarily antagonistic towards not only Yahusha, but to all of those Yehudim Jews, Israelites, who acknowledged him, who followed him. And they, one of the things that they have vociferous copies of in their Talmud is the writings from the followers of Yahusha, which were written in Hebrew, that had the name of Yahweh in them. And they talk about how they would go about discarding them. They wanted to burn them, and yet there was a rabbinical rule against discarding, burning a text that had Yahweh's name on it. And so they were really confused as to how to rid the world of the Hebrew copies that were written by Matanyah and Yohanan. They came up with this fancy justification for religiously confiscating these documents, killing the writers, and then burning the Hebrew copies. And so we don't have any extant copies. And, there was a period of time both in between 66 and 70 CE, and then between 133 and 135-6 CE, when rabbinical Jews held tremendous political sway in Jerusalem, through Yehuda Yisrael, because they were in open conflict, open rebellion against the Romans. While the Romans were empowered, the rabbinical community couldn't do very much, But when they rose up against Rome, which they did in 66 through 70 CE, and again from 133 through 136, 135, 136 CE, they had enormous influence. And the rabbinical Jews, both times, were a faction that sought ultimate control from other factions. And there were a number of civil wars both times within Israel as they were preparing to fight the Romans. And so it was during these periods that they hunted down and killed followers of the way, which they couldn't do otherwise under Roman control, and where they burned the manuscripts of Yahuchanan and Matanyah that were written in Hebrew. Now, the other two eyewitness accounts that we have of Yosha's words and deeds, I'm trying to give you now a perspective on what we have from this period in writing so that you understand how Paul's letters fit into that context and chronology. While Yahuchanan and Matanyah were eyewitnesses, and while their original copies in Hebrew would have been awesomely valuable because they would have had what was said in the language that it was said, Yosha spoke very little Aramaic. He spoke a lot of Hebrew. And so it would have been vastly more important to have his testimony in Hebrew. And even that which was a little bit which was in Aramaic was spoken in a language extraordinarily close to Hebrew. But Greek isn't even remotely close to Hebrew. And so you just lose so much of what was said. And the Greek scribes were far freer to edit text and change it for their whoever was paying them than was ever the case in Hebrew text. But we probably would have had a copy of Matanyah and Yahuchanan in Hebrew dating to within 10 years of Yosha's fulfillment of Pesach, Matzah, Bekorim. So sometime between 33 CE and 43 CE. But there's no extant copy. All we have is Hebrew or Greek codexes that were translated in Alexandria, Egypt. And they date to the early 2nd century CE, very far removed from the time. But it gives you a chronology. Now, Mark was Shimon Kephesh's translator because Shimon Kephesh, like most Hebrew fishermen, like most Jewish fishermen, spoke Hebrew. He spoke Hebrew. He read Hebrew. He did not speak Aramaic. He most certainly didn't speak Latin, and he didn't speak or write Greek. So when speaking to other audiences, Shimon Kephesh needed a translator. Mark was his translator. And so the book of Mark was compiled probably sometime around 60 or 70 CE by Mark, based upon what he had translated Shimon Kephesh, known to the world as Peter, had said. So it's a hearsay document. Then, as it relates to Luke was a companion for many years of Paul. And that's why Luke is the author of Acts. He's not only the author of Luke, but also the book of Acts. Everything he writes is hearsay. He was not present when anything was occurring. So he is clearly a hearsay source. But he's made a tremendous effort, at least in the book of Luke, to present what he was told. You just should never look at it as being divinely inspired. It wasn't. It's a hearsay historical account, probably compiled around 65 CE or later. But keep in mind that Luke, who ascribed in Acts Paul's very contradictory testimony to what Luke had already written that he had heard Yosha had said and done in the book of Luke, that somewhere along the process, Luke turned on Paul. By the time that Paul was writing his last letters, which would be his love letters to Timothy, no one, there wasn't anyone who was still in the Pauline camp. No one trusted Paul. Everyone who knew Paul abandoned him. That's why it's so amazing that Paul now is the founder of the Christian religion, that his letters dominate the New Testament of the Christian Bible, is that Paul, by his own admission, not only was insane, not only was demon-possessed, but by his own admission, he was without a friend in the world. Everyone abandoned him. And for good reason. Now, from a timing point of view with Paul's letters, the first letter to the Galatians is a response to what's called the Jerusalem Council, where Paul was called into Jerusalem because his preaching was wholly contradictory to the Torah. And Yosha had affirmed the Torah and told the disciples that if anybody in any way, shape, or form negates any aspect of the Torah, that they will be considered lowly and little. Now, the name that Paul ascribed for himself, Paulos, in Latin means lowly and little. Shaul, which is his birth name, his Hebrew name, means question him. He wrote Galatians as a rebuttal to the Jerusalem summit, where he was chastised for condemning and contradicting the Torah and its covenant. And so in Galatians, he lays out his claim to being God's chosen one, to being the one person that God chose to deliver his new message, a message of faith to the world of non-Jews, and to be above and beyond any of the disciples that Yosha actually met with, selected, and taught. And so it is his claims to authority and superiority that we find in Galatians, along with Paul's rebuttal to the Jerusalem Council, in addition to Paul presenting the literal foundation of Pauline doctrine. It's all in Galatians, and it was written sometime between 50 and 52 CE, and it was his first letter. We'll speak more on this when we return to Shattering Myths after the commercial break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're trying to provide a context for Paul's letters vis-a-vis the rest of the so-called Christian New Testament. And by way of quick review, the only two eyewitness accounts were written by Yohanan and Matanyah. Matanyah means Yahweh's gift. Yohanan means Yahweh's merciful. Their eyewitness accounts are available now to us through the book of John and the book of Matthew. The other two accounts that are considered to be biographical are Luke and Mark, but both of those are hearsay. Luke comes to us via a historian's perspective, but it is all hearsay. He was not an eyewitness to any of what was said or done. And the same is true with Mark, that most likely served as a Latin translator for Shimon Kefesh, known as Peter. Now, they were in their Greek versions. The two eyewitness accounts were probably written sometime between at the earliest, perhaps 40 CE. 7 years after Yosha fulfilled all of this, and maybe would have been written in Hebrew more expeditiously than that. Could have been written, you know, within 3 to 5 years of the time that Yosha fulfilled all of the Torah's promises in 33 CE, which is year 4000 Yah. But the original copies were in Hebrew. Almost all of the original copies were seized and burned by the rabbinical community. And so all we have now is Greek translations of those Hebrew texts. And the oldest Greek translations date to the early 2nd century, 100 years from the time that the events occurred. So there would have been, by the time that they're translated into Greek and we have copies of the Greek texts, they're 100 years removed. Paul's letter to the Galatians would have been written no earlier than late 50 CE, could have been written as late as maybe 51 or 52 CE. So that's the timing of it. He did not have access to the Hebrew versions of Matanyahu Yohanan because Paul never cites anything Yosha says. So he knows nothing of what Yosha says and did. I mean, literally nothing. His letters fill half of the Christian New Testament. There's not a single citation from Yosha in any of those books, which is alarming if you're a Christian, because he claims to have met with him and claims to be his apostle, and yet he never quotes anything that he says and done and did. In fact, rejects everything that he says and did. The to give you a word's eye view geographically as to where Galatia stands is that Paul was born in Tarsus. Tarsus is on the Mediterranean coast of modern-day Turkey, just inland, but essentially a coastal town. Extraordinarily close to the coast, I should say. And it, if you were to go 20 miles north from Tarsus, you would be in the south eastern part of Galatia. Galatia was a very large province that covered almost all of what is today central Turkey. At this time, it was under Roman dominion because the Romans conquered the Greeks, and the Greeks had conquered the Persians. So central Turkey was under Persian control, the Greeks, Alexander the Great, defeated Darius II and took control of all of the Persian holdings. So it was under Greek control, under Greek influence. And the Greek influence, by the way, was never eradicated from central Turkey, at least during the time of Paul. The Greek culture prevailed, even though it was a Roman province, because the Romans subsequently beat the Greeks in battle. So it was a large Roman province, and Galatia would have comprised almost all of central Turkey. There were coastal provinces around it, and Paul's birthplace, Tarsus, was due south of Galatia. So now you have the geography of his audience. At the time that Paul was writing to the Galatians, first of all, we understand that this was a very large province that comprised the majority of modern day Turkey. It was under Roman control. It became a Roman province under Augustus, Caesar Augustus, Octavian, if you prefer. And it was comprised of what the Romans called Celts, but the rest of the world referred to as Gauls. So it was a province at war with Rome, and a province that had been at peace with Greece. They were under Persian control for many years. The Persian influence, while Persia had its issues, the Persians were spectacular in a number of areas. The Persians were spectacular at building roadways. They were spectacular at imposing a national language so the people could communicate with each other. Of course, that language would have been Aramaic. The Persians came up with a universal tax system to enable a really economic trading between all of their various constituencies, and they were fairly vigorous in educational training. So those would have been the Celts in Turkey. They'd been under Persian influence, then under Greek influence. And don't think for a moment, you know, a lot of people think, oh, well, Alexander the Great and Greece and, you know, marvelous culture and democracy and all this. There was no democracy in Greece at this time. It was a standard dictatorship where the king was also general. Alexander was ruthless. He was... deluded everyone into worshiping him as if he were God. But that's not to say that Greek culture didn't influence this region. It did, and it had a tremendous influence. The culture would have been very Gnostic, which was the Greek philosophy that was articulated not only by Plato, but also by Aristotle, that was Alexander's forced tutor. Alexander didn't choose, Aristotle didn't choose to tutor Alexander. He was compelled into doing it because his father had ruthlessly brutalized Aristotle's community. And this was a way to liberate his community from Philip's draconian measures. But gives you an idea. So you've got the Persian influence, you've got the Greek influence. Now it is a Roman province. The Romans were also vicious. The Gauls, or the Celts, were universally opposed to Rome. They did not like the Romans because the Romans not only secured enormous amounts of taxes from them and tribute payments, but also... the Romans required all young men between the ages of about 15 and 45 to devote a minimum of 20 years to serving in the Roman legions. So the most productive individuals within the community were taken out of the community to impose the will of the Romans upon that community. So that's the background of who these people were, what they, what their proclivities were, and the timing of Paul writing it, which is to set himself apart from the disciples, because he wanted to carve out a large swath of territory for himself. Now, as Paul begins to craft this, you need to understand that Paul positions himself as a murderer of the followers of Yahusha. There was no such thing as a Christian at this time. And the followers of Yahusha were never called Christians. They were at one time referred to as Christusians. Yahusha was given a Greek title, Christus. But Christus and Christos are very different words. One means drugged, the Christos, which is the basis of Christian in Christ, means to apply drugs, where Christus is a useful implement. But at this time, there was no one being called by that name, and the followers of Yahusha were almost universally, but not completely, but nearly universally, Torah observant Yehudim, Jews, and Israelites. And Paul wanted to break that. He wanted the rest of the world for his control. So he begins, Paulos. Now, Paulos is not his given name. It's interesting that he chose not to write under his name. And it may be because he was off murdering and torturing and imprisoning anyone who accepted Yahusha as the Messiah, as the work of Yahweh, is the set apart, diminished manifestation of Yahweh. And so he chose a Latin name, a Roman name. That is extraordinarily telling that he chose to write under a different name. And he chose Paulos, which means little and lowly in Latin, which will play very large as we read through what Yahusha ultimately has to say about him. But one of the things that I learned when I started writing Prophet of Doom is that I knew I had a message that was going to be not only unpopular, but was going to cause Muslims to want to hunt me down and kill me. That virtually everyone that has written effectively against Islam has chosen a different name and not used their real name. And when I was doing this on behalf of Yahweh, I was encouraged to use my actual name because he was actually going to protect me. And therefore, there's vastly more credibility if you're willing to write under your own name and say, you know, I'm going to stand up against the death threats. Shaul didn't do that. He chose a different name. Now he had been a rabbinical student and a rabbi under Shaul, but he chose to change his name to a Roman name, Paulos. Now, he would have done so for a number of reasons. One, of course, is not to be identified with his past. The second would be the fact that in the Greek culture, Jews were despised. The Greeks despised Jews. And if you recognize that Greece today, 80% of Greeks are anti-Semitic. It's the most anti-Semitic country in the world. And a lot of that is because of the ongoing fixation of Greeks with the Plato version of reality, where the real world was an inferior copy of the of this other world, this other universe that was perfect. And so the things of the flesh, the things of the world, were always inferior. And the imagined spiritual realm was superior. Well, that philosophy became known as Gnosticism. And so the Gnostics thought that the Jews were savage because, for example, circumcision is something that's of the flesh, and they thought it was a way to grotesquely mar the fixation of their lust. I mean, Greeks became, most Greeks were bisexual. Women with women, men with men, and men with women, and even bestiality was also practiced in Greece. They thought that the Jews were therefore extraordinarily inferior. In fact, most of the Roman antagonism towards Jews was actually inspired by the Romans adopting Greek culture. Now, the Romans were also anti-Semitic, and they were anti-Semitic for a number of reasons. Initially, it was because the Jews were the only captured people that would not accept the Roman gods. And the Jews were the only, Judea was the only province, and it was Iuda, that during, in Latin, Iuda, that the province of Iuda, Yahuda, would not acknowledge that the Roman emperors were gods, and they would not erect statues of the Roman emperors in their temples, which every other Roman province did. The Roman emperors, starting with Octavian, Caesar Augustus, demanded that their statues be erected in the center of every town and in all of the temples along with the other gods, and that the Roman pantheon be accepted along with the other gods. But in Yahuda, neither was acceptable. And so the Jews were therefore considered as less desirable peoples. And so if Paul had marketed himself under a Jewish name to a community that was under the control of the Romans and that was under the influence of the Greeks, he would be rejected by his name alone. And therefore, he spoke to them as Paulos, taking a Latin name. Now, when you recognize that 100% of Yahusha's prophets, those who he had spoke through, all had Hebrew names, without exception. Everyone had Hebrew names. And you've got this one guy hanging out there with a Latin Roman name, it ought to tell you a great deal. In fact, it's interesting that Yahusha, in the Sermon on the Mount, he's actually he's frustrated with those who are listening to him. And he says, you know, I come in my Father's name. That's why his name is important to know. As Yahusha, it means Yahweh saves. I come in my Father's name, and yet you do not accept me. And yet another will come in his own name, and him you will accept. And it shows that this one who came in a name that he himself chose, and there's only one of them that did this, Paul, Paulos, that his testimony is obviously different than Yahusha's testimony, because to accept one, you have to reject the other. And there's only one person that qualifies for that admonition by God himself against this individual who chose the name Paulos. So the first stroke of Paul's pen begins Paulos, announcing that he had changed his name, that he didn't like his Hebrew name, Shaul. Paulos. Then he calls himself an apostle. Not from men, not even by means of man, but to the contrary, on behalf of Iesu Christu and God, Father, of the one having roused and awakened him out of a lifeless corpse. All right, I'm going to begin at the beginning of this. We've already talked about the name change, which sets this one man apart from everyone else and makes this one man the only person that could have been the individual that Yahusha said, I come in my Father's name, but you do not accept me, but another will come in his own name, and him you will accept. And that's not good if you're Paul or if you're a Christian. And there's no other viable candidate. None. Now, as we move to an apostle. Apostle is a Greek title, and therefore, because it's a Greek title, we don't really have any way of sanctifying it and saying, for example, well, that title was specifically afforded to Yahusha's disciples. No, it wasn't, because it's a Greek title, and Yahusha didn't speak Greek, and his disciples didn't speak Greek, and they didn't have Greek titles. But in the Greek translations of what Yahusha said, apostle means a messenger who is sent forth. It is a prepared delegate who is dispatched. It is from stello, one who is set, placed, and prepared, and apo, to be separated. So apo, to be separated, and stello, to be a delegate who is set in place and prepared. So that's the meaning of the word. He is claiming now that he was not established by any man, that he was not even given this title by means of a man, but that the contrary, on behalf of Iesu Christu. Now, Iesu Christu would be read as Jesus Christ in your English translations. That's a real problem. First of all, it comes to us by way of placeholders. Something that most Christians do not know is that the basis from which they get Jesus Christ or Christ Jesus never appears in any one of the pre-Constantine manuscripts. In fact, even the first Constantinian manuscripts in the mid-4th century continued the practice of placeholders. And so we have copies of Paul's letter that date all the way back to the end of the first century CE, probably 30 years after they were originally penned by Paul. And he used placeholders. So with the placeholders, if we're looking at the placeholders in the Septuagint, for example, what you're going to find is that the name Yahusha, and that would be the sixth book of the of Yahweh's Hebrew testimony in his Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. The fifth book is named after, and the author of it is Yahusha. You're going to find Yahusha initially written out in Hebrew. Then you're going to find it presented in the Septuagint, the Greek translation, as a Hebrew name within the Greek text. And then later you're going to find a Greek placeholder representing Yahusha, in the midst of the Greek translations. That's where these the whole concept of the placeholders came from. All right, so that gives you a little basis as to where all of this is derived. Now, that being the case, there is no justification for getting Iusu out of the text, much less Iusus or Iusun. And those are the three ways that that the name is rendered in text that were written after the second half of the fourth century. Now, this would be now 400 years after the eyewitnesses wrote these original texts in Hebrew. And so he even has it as Iusu Christu, which would make Iusu the first name and Christu the second name. But there is absolutely no basis for that. Christ is not a name, nor is Christu or Christus. So almost everything he's saying here is showing I'm a fraud. We'll be back tomorrow.